Well, today's message is going to be probably a very different kind of message than one that I would normally preach or one that I would deliver, even that Paul would deliver. And I think the best way to introduce it is to play you a clip from, for some, a very well-known movie from a number of years ago entitled Glory. Glory is the story of the 54th Massachusetts Regiment and their leader, Robert Gould Shaw. So just watch closely, pay special attention to when he speaks to the color bearer, and then I'll come back up and we'll explain to you why this clip is so important.
And carry on.
I will.
Huzzah! Huzzah! Huzzah!
I'll see you in the fort, Thomas.
There's a reason why that clip is important to this message. If you listened, you heard him say about the color bearer. He pointed at him and he said, if this man should fall, who will lift the flag and carry on? Well, that's the question that I want to ask you today. Now, let me set up the story that you just heard. The 54th Massachusetts was the very first black regiment to serve in the Union Army. For months, even for a few years, even Northerners had argued that blacks were not capable of being trained well enough to serve in the military, other than to maybe serve as common laborers, that they couldn't be trusted to fight on the battlefield. And so Robert Gould Shaw, his family were very influential politically in Boston. And they were able to put enough pressure on the federal government that they approved of the formation of the first black regiment. It was the 54th Regiment out of Massachusetts to be raised from that state. They were primarily, at least leadership, from Boston, these black men from all over the Massachusetts area. And I lead tours periodically to Plymouth and Boston. And what you're looking at there is a bronze relief that is right on the outskirts of the Boston Commons. And when I lead tours to Boston, one of the things we do is we look at that. That is depicting the moment when the 54th Massachusetts marched through the city of Boston to enter into their service in the war between the states. Now, what you were just watching a clip of is the second assault on Fort Wagner on the coast of South Carolina. Fort Wagner was a southern fort that had been well designed, very fortified, and was a key to the fall of South Carolina. Fort Sumter was out in the bay, not far from there. And it had been so designed that the approach to the fort was narrow enough that only one regiment at a time could assault the fort. Now, if you know anything about tactics in those days, that meant that the full force of the army could not be brought to bear on that fort at any given moment. Now, what is interesting about the 54th's participation in this assault is that they volunteered to be the first regiment to assault Fort Wagner. Now, that's much like being in the first wave on the beaches of Normandy on D-Day in June of 1944. Those first boys took the brunt of the machine gun fire and all these other things, and some of the greatest casualties were accumulated in that first wave. So these men would be the first wave. Now, Robert Gould Shaw led those men, and they indeed did assault Fort Wagner. Unfortunately, their assault was not successful, even though they did reach the fort and reach the parapet of the fort. They incurred 50% casualties. They started with about 600 soldiers, and they had almost 300 casualties in that assault. One of those casualties was their commander, Shaw. In fact, he was stripped of a lot of his commander's clothing and decorations and was buried in a common trench grave there with his other soldiers. His father commented later that it was comforting for him to know that he was resting there with the men that he loved so much. Now, during that assault, as you saw depicted in that introduction right before they assault the fort, the flag bearer was the target. In fact, they were the targets during the war between the states and most of the battles, as we'll talk about later on. And during that assault, the flag bearer actually fell. And so this gentleman right here, Sergeant William Kearney, was the one that the movie was talking about. Who will then lift up the flag and carry on? He was the one who did so. Heroically. In fact, he was seriously wounded, but was able to get the flag all of the way to the top of the fort. And when they finally had to retreat because the fire was so fierce, he refused to surrender the flag. And holding his wound with one hand to try to slow the bleeding, he carried that flag all the way back to safety. When he got to the place of safety, he said, "Boys, I did but my duty. The dear old flag never touched the ground." Well, because of his heroic actions, in 1900, a much older William Kearney was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. What did he do? He lifted up the flag. Now, why is that important to what I'm talking about today? Well, for the last two, certainly longer than that, but the last 2 years, we have watched an ever-increasing stranglehold of the federal government, especially led by those who are leftists, I believe pure communists, in trying to squeeze the life out of whatever is left of our republic. We have watched with the lies about COVID. We've discovered that after 2 years of that, its death rate was about 1%. Now, for those, it was awful, and we all experienced, most of us, COVID, and some more seriously than others, so I'm not trying to minimize the impact, but about a 1% death rate. This monkeypox that we're now hearing so much about is overwhelmingly spread by homosexual activity. Over 95% of all the cases are in the homosexual crowd. And its death rate so far is about 5%. So we've been lied to about so many things, but the events of this week are just beyond the pale. And I think what we've seen with the raid on Mar-a-Lago is a turn in the federal government's strategy. Most of us believe that the left has been able to infiltrate the present administration, probably from the Oval Office all the way down. The Department of Justice is nothing about justice. They're about political vendetta and pushing an agenda of socialism / I believe more pure communism. Communism is an amazing thing because it has failed everywhere it's been tried. And yet, liberal professors in America will tell students in universities and colleges, well, the only reason communism has failed is it's never had a fair chance. If we tried it in America, it would work. Well, sure, it would work. It would make all of us poverty-stricken and subjects of an oligarchy and a tyranny. So, yeah, it'll work all right. Exactly how it's designed to work, which is just to destroy personal value and liberty. But we've watched this ever-increasing stranglehold. I think this week with the raid at Mar-a-Lago, and we're hearing all kinds of mixed messages about why. The amazing thing is the feds were just there in June and saw clearly the papers that they claimed to be after. And the only suggestion that they made is that they improve the locks that were on the doors protecting those documents, which the Trump people immediately did. And then all of a sudden, this week, unannounced, no announcement to Trump's attorneys, no announcement in any way, they raid Mar-a-Lago while he's not there, supposedly to get these papers that he's not supposed to have. Now they're saying, well, it was papers containing sensitive material about nuclear secrets and all that kind of stuff. Yes, and I guess all those papers that Hillary had and all those emails, that had nothing to do with any of that, right? Well, why such a dramatic response? And as you see the pictures, notice they even chose to send officers there with fully automatic weapons. This was more than just going to get some documents. In fact, the Trump attorneys asked to see the search warrant, and they were not allowed any closer than 10 feet. Now, tell me how well you can read a government document at 10 feet. They even asked if they could go in and supervise the raid or the search, and were not allowed even into the property. And those federal agents spent 9 hours going through even the personal clothing of Mrs. Trump. Now, why do I think that this is important? I think it's a shift. I think we're seeing a bold, right out in the open statement to this leftist and our federal government that we can do anything we want to do. We can twist the laws any way we want to twist them. And we're doing this to show you that we can. I no more believe that they were there to actually get documents that they thought they needed to get. I think they were there to send a message loud and clear. And that message is this: Trump, you can't run again. And people, if we can do this to a former president, we can do it to you. And I believe that was the message that was being sent. On the same day, a representative in Congress from Pennsylvania, Scott Perry, was on vacation with his family without any warning, without any contacting his attorneys. On vacation, federal agents confronted him and seized his cell phone. They're now claiming that they believe that he was a part of the January 6th insurrection. If that was an insurrection, it was the lousiest insurrection in history. And it's the only one I've ever read about where the insurrectionists didn't have weapons, of all things. Now, all of us would agree that those people shouldn't have gone into the Capitol like they did. But the greatest crime that any of them have basically been charged with is trespassing. And yet you realize that some of them are still in solitary confinement today. 2 years later. What about Hunter Biden? What about President Biden, who we have on videotape bragging that he was blackmailing the Ukrainian government over investigating his son? What about Hillary Clinton and all of those thousands of emails and computers that a program called BleachBit was used to erase the hard drives and cell phones that were crushed with hammers? What about all the things that Bill Clinton did when he was in office? What about all of these connections to Jeffrey Epstein with all of these leftists and all that kind of nonsense? Notice none of that. None of that is important. All that's important is if you're a conservative. And then if you're a conservative, we're going to do whatever we want to do to you. In fact, I said to Paul this week, you know, we are right back where we were in the 1770s. Now, I want you to think about this. In the 1770s, American citizens, who really were British citizens, were being searched. without proper cause. They were having their personal papers and property seized by the British government without due process. They were being forced to house British soldiers, and I'm sure those soldiers took perfect care of those people's houses and didn't demand the lion's share and the best of the food. And then Parliament, in collusion with King George, were actually passing laws like the Intolerable Acts, which basically said, we can pass any law we want to pass and make it binding only on you people in America, and we don't even have to make them binding on the English citizens in Great Britain. And called them the Intolerable Acts. Friends, we're exactly there today, and I would argue in worse shape than they were in those days. That's why, for instance, the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment were so important. Improper search and seizure. See, there's reasons why those people in that generation put what they thought to be the safeguards in place to keep that from ever happening again. And yet, we have two sets of laws, ones that apply to people like the Bidens and the Clintons and others, and then we have a different set of laws that apply to us. If any of us were guilty of only a fraction of what Hunter Biden is guilty of, or Nancy Pelosi and her husband are guilty of, we'd all already be in prison. Now, why is this all important? Why am I bringing all of this up? Is it because I'm wanting to be political? No, I don't want to be political at all. In 2011... Harvey Silverglade, who is a Boston civil rights lawyer, released or published a book entitled Three Felonies a Day. In that book, he documented that because of the way laws are being written in America today, the average American is guilty of committing at least three felonies every day, and we don't even know it. In fact, here is a short summary of the book that you can find online. It says the average professional in this country wakes up in the morning, goes to work, comes home, eats dinner, and then goes to sleep unaware that he or she has likely committed several federal crimes that day. Why? The answer lies in the very nature of modern federal criminal laws, which have exploded in number but also become impossibly broad and vague. In Three Felonies a Day, Harvey A. Silverglade reveals how federal criminal laws have become dangerously disconnected from the English common law tradition. And by the way, that's the tradition our laws and our form of government and republic were originally based on. So, how they've become disconnected from the English common law tradition, and how prosecutors can pin arguable federal crimes on any one of us for even the most seemingly innocuous behavior. Now, the reason why I'm preaching this message to you today is because I believe we may be facing a new day, but it's not a better day. For years, Paul and I have been preaching and trying to warn Christians to give up the casual Christianity, to stop this nonsense of separation of church and state, to quit playing church and start being the church. We've encouraged Christians to engage, to bring salt and light back into our republic, knowing that if that salt and light is not there, then like in every other area of our culture, you have decay and darkness. This is why Jesus said, you're the salt of the earth, the light of the world. He didn't say the salt of the church and the light of the church. He said the salt of the earth and the light of the world. We're to be in the world, bringing our Christianity outside these walls. But the typical Christian church today, their Christianity is within the walls. And if you talk about anything political or even something that might sound remotely political, you're committing the sin of mixing politics and religion, and that's betraying the Constitution and the Bible, and we're just not going to have that around here. And so for years, Paul and I have been warning about this. And now with this new piece of legislation that the Democrats have shoved through, they're going to hire 87,000 new IRS agents. Do you realize that once those IRS agents are hired, that will make the IRS larger than, get this, the Pentagon, the State Department, the FBI, and the Border Patrol combined. Larger than all of those combined. Now, who do you think those 87,000 IRS agents are going to come after? Because if you read portions of their new job descriptions. They're encouraged to be able to know how to use firearms and to execute their responsibilities with deadly force if necessary. IRS agents? My wife and I, years ago, were at a wedding rehearsal dinner of a wedding that I was performing for a guy that I roomed with in college. We were in Little Rock, Arkansas. At the wedding rehearsal dinner, they seated us at tables, and we were obviously getting to know people that we had never met before. And there was a guy that's just a few years older than us who was an IRS agent. Now, this is way back in the 80s. And he started telling stories and laughing about how he intimidated people and how he had helped people, he helped put people out of business by just taxing their businesses into bankruptcy, and how he had gone after individuals and ruined them financially. And he would just sit there and laugh about it. You see, IRS agents are not promoted in ways like we all are typically promoted. The way they're promoted is by the kills that they get. I'll call them kills. You see, the more money they're able to extract, the more blood they're able to squeeze out of the turnip, the more likely they are to be promoted and to be given bonuses. So they are highly motivated. To show you how motivated they are, and to show you that these IRS agents are not going to be primarily targeting billionaires and millionaires, Santa Cruz University just released a recent study. The study showed that people that make $25,000 per year or less are five times more likely to be audited by the IRS than people who make more. Now you chew on that for just a moment. What could you possibly squeeze out of people that make $25,000 a year or less? Well, I think here's the reason. Number one, those people can't afford attorneys and fleets of high-zook accountants. So they have to face the IRS alone. And the IRS will come up with $500, $700, $1,000 that they claim they owe. And these people are so terrified, they'll find a way to get it, to pay them off, to get them to leave them alone. And that IRS agent gets to go away with another notch on his belt. The other reason they do that is it sends a signal. The signal is, we're watching you. And we'll come after you anytime we want. And remember, the IRS laws are different from all of our other laws. See, in all of our other laws in America, you are innocent until proven guilty. With the IRS, you're guilty until you can prove yourself innocent. So if they decide to come after you and freeze your assets, garnish your wages, they really don't have to have a whole lot of proof. And you're going to have to hire some attorneys, and you're going to have to fight through the court system, which sometimes takes months to do. They're using unlimited federal resources and federal attorneys. It isn't costing them anything. They can stay in court with you and litigate you till the cows come home, but you can't afford to do that. And in the process, you can be ruined financially. You say, well, what does that have to do with you and Paul on the screen? Well, because Paul's a tax dodger. Don't you remember when he was running for office? Obviously, he's not. Let me tell you what this has to do with us. I don't know what kind of lists they keep, they meaning these lefties in the federal government, but I'll bet you he and I are on one. Back in 2008, he and I participated in an attempt to challenge the Johnson Amendment, and we sent sermons to the IRS with letters saying, this is what I did in my pulpit yesterday, and we defied the Johnson Amendment and endorsed candidates from our pulpits. Now, the IRS didn't do anything then because they knew they couldn't. But I've been warning people that if we don't wake up and stand up, eventually the IRS will be weaponized, and they will be the equivalent to the brown shirts of the Nazis of the 1930s and 40s in Germany. And friends, I believe that is exactly what we're watching before our very eyes right now. I think the raid on Mar-a-Lago, I think the seizure of a congressman's cell phone without any warning, without due process, and the hiring of these 87,000 new IRS agents is all a part of a brand new strategy. Maybe it's not brand new. Maybe they've been after this all along. And so I do believe, though I hope it never happens, that there could come a day when they come after Paul and or me personally. And if they want us bad enough, they'll get us. I'm just telling you right now. They can do anything they want to do. They've already proven that. If they can do that to the former president of the United States, they can do it to me in a heartbeat. You realize that they have the ability to electronically plant stuff on our computers if they want to. They could plant child porn on my computer. They may have planted it already, and it's in a way that I can't even find it. I don't know. But they can do that kind of stuff. They can find laws that I've broken. Look at the book that I just mentioned a while ago. Every day we all commit about 3 felonies. We didn't even know it. And if they want to press it, they can. So what happens if they do? What do we do? When I was pastoring in Poto years ago, back in the 80s, I had driven my wife's little Datsun pickup. It was a little club cab, but those things are small. I'd driven it about 45 minutes south to Kaimishi Baptist Assembly, where our church was building a new church cabin. Kaimishi Baptist Assembly is a lot like Falls Creek. It's just not nearly as large. Churches build cabins, and then they send their kids there in the summer for youth camp. So we were working on the cabin. It had been raining that day. And so on the way back home, that cab of that truck, it was in the fall, got kind of warm and toasty. And before I know it, I caught myself kind of nodding off. And then, as all of us know, when you fall asleep, you don't know you have fallen asleep. I fell asleep at the wheel. In fact, I was almost into downtown Poto when I heard the sound of weeds and other things hitting the bottom of that little pickup. Well, that woke me up. Of course, you know what happens when you're startled, when you're awakened, when you're not ready to be. And I looked, and my truck was completely off the shoulder, and I was off into the grass. Now, I told you it had been raining, and so the ground is very wet and muddy. And I started fighting the wheel of that little pickup, and that's not easy to do. I was going way too fast because I was asleep. I didn't know how fast I was going. So I'm fighting that little truck, and finally I get it up under the shoulder, and then the best that I can tell, one of the front tires blew out because of the strain that I was putting on them. When that happened, it made a beeline for a little creek that I'd never really paid much attention to. I'd crossed over that creek tons of times, but I'd never paid any attention to it. But today it had rained a lot, so it was pretty high. And there was one of these concrete box culverts. You know, we all see them on the road, but we don't normally notice them because we drive over them and there's no superstructure like a big bridge to notice. And they have these concrete walls that go out like this, right? Well, those are a lot taller than you think they are. And those are bigger than you typically think they are because you don't even notice them. Well, this little pickup makes a beeline for that. And I'm trying to fight it. I just can't stop it. And finally, before I knew it, boom, right off that wall I went. Now, if you've watched Dukes of Hazzard and you've watched their cars do that, that's not the direction cars go. When I went over that concrete, just like that, nose first, right into that muddy water, it splashed and then, boom, it hit the bottom and then it flipped over onto its top. Now, there's not a lot of room in a little Datsun pickup, especially those pickups of those days. But somehow, even though the back window broke out, water was rushing in, I'm thinking I'm going to drown. I ended up right side up in an upside down little Datsun pickup. The back window that had completely shattered shredded Pam's raincoat that was draped across the passenger seat. Why I wasn't cut to pieces, it looked like someone had taken a butcher knife to that raincoat. Well, there I am in that truck. I'm right side up. The water's rushing in. I'm trying to get, you know, my senses back to me, and I finally forced the door open enough to get out. The water is about chest deep. If it had knocked me out, I'd have drowned. I didn't have one scratch. Not one. Bang my knee, that's it. Showed up at the house later on covered in mud and water, and my wife thought I was a dead man. I mean, she didn't know what in the world to do. She said, Dan Fisher, let me tell you something. Someday when you do die, your angels are going to have their tongues hanging out, and they're going to be puffing and puffing saying, I'm glad he's dead. We get a rest. Anyway, the reason I tell you that story is to tell you this. The thing that woke me up, those weeds, woke me up too late. It's too late to do anything about it. I'm going to have a wreck. Can't stop it. People ask me, Dan, what about America? I honestly have to tell you, I don't know. We have murdered over 62 million preborn babies. We've done so many evil things in the name of liberty and justice. God doesn't need any justification to wipe us off the planet. My prayer, like Paul's, is that there would be some kind of awakening, that my children and my grandchildren would enjoy the liberties that I've enjoyed, but I can't count on that. So let me ask you this question. Let's say that the feds come after the two of us, and if they want us bad enough, they'll get us. I've already said that. They'll trump up stuff. There won't be any way for us to beat it. We'll try, but chances are, if they want us bad enough, it's not going to be a thing we can do. What happens then? What if someday we both just disappear? And I would like to think that that's the rapture, but I know he ain't going. So what if... So what happens? I mean, really, seriously. Now you say, well, Dan, you think it could get that bad? Oh, I pray not. But I'm telling you, if we don't pull this republic out of the nosedive that it's in, friends, we are going to crash right into the ground. God owes us nothing. Owes us nothing. So what happens if he and I disappear? What are you going to do? Well, I hope that someone will lift up the flag and carry on. Who will? Very quickly, the Bible talks a lot about flags. In fact, the Bible tells us that we literally march under the banner of the Lord. Psalm 60, verse 4, you have given a banner to those who fear you, that it may be displayed because of the truth. Psalm 20, verse 5. We will rejoice in your salvation, and in the name of our God, we will set up our banners! Exclamation point. In Exodus 17, that we'll come back to in just a moment, Moses and the children of Israel are getting ready to fight Amalek at a place called Rephidim. And the Bible says, and Moses built an altar and called its name, the Lord is my banner. You may know that as Jehovah Nisi or Yahweh Nisi. It means, his banner is the one I march under. He is my banner. Did you know that that was one of the names of the Lord, that we march under his banner? But we not only march under his banner, friends, we fight under his banner. Now, when I say that, when I use the word fight, my critics always want to say, yep, see, that's right, Dan. You want to fight. You want a civil war. No one in their right mind wants a war of bullets and bombs. But friends, we are in a war for our future. We are in a war, at least at the spiritual level right now, for our liberties and our rights. Friends, can you not see it? Can you not sense it? Can you not hear it? So we're at war, whether we want to be or not. Exodus 17, 16, back to that passage. For Moses said, because the Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Now, Amalek was real, but do you know who Amalek actually represents in Scripture? And all these other foreign armies and pagans? The leftists that we're facing right now. You see, since the fall in the Garden of Eden, there has been a war between light and dark going on. And mankind has been caught in this war. And so all of those Old Testament examples are just a literal example of the spiritual war that we fight. Listen to Exodus 14, 14. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. Deuteronomy 20, verse 4. The Lord had said to Joshua, for the Lord your God is he who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you. You say, well, Dan, that's all that Old Testament fighting stuff. Well, let's go to the New Testament. 1 Corinthians 9, 26. Therefore, Paul says, I run, not with uncertainty. I fight, but not as one who beats at the air. Now, I don't ever remember reading about Paul being a boxer or a soldier. Obviously, he's talking about fighting the spiritual war. But friends, that's actually a more important war than any physical war would ever be. In fact, I would argue that all physical wars are due to the fact that someone was not right fighting the spiritual war hard enough, and the physical war was able to appear. And for years, the church has just sat on its blessed assurance, and we've turned the organ up, and we sing louder while the world is melting down around us, and then we wonder what's happened. Pastors will not have me do the black robe presentation, won't have Paul to speak. Now, we have some who do. This is why we're doing our boot camps all over the country. We're trying to find that remnant. We're trying to find that low-hanging fruit, if you will. Pastors who want to engage, they just may not know how. And we're trying to help them. To this point, we have trained, if you can believe it, over 1,100 pastors on how to be modern-day black robe preachers. But friends, that's just a drop in the bucket unless God chooses to use a mere remnant. Majority of Christians today are sitting around talking about let's be nice, and if we'll all be nice, won't it be nice around here? Ain't that nice? And mild-mannered preachers preach mild-mannered sermons to mild-mannered congregations who walk out more mild-mannered than when they walked in. And the world is more the child of hell than ever. Paul says to Timothy, fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life. Fight the good fight. So we not only march under the banner of the Lord, we fight under the banner of the Lord. And third, we die under the banner of the Lord. You say, what? Listen to what Paul says as he's getting ready to die. He writes to young Timothy and he says in 2 Timothy chapter 4, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. He was about to die under that banner that he had fought and marched under for so long. Now, you just saw a clip depicting the 54th Massachusetts, a Union regiment. Well, I'm going to go to the other side, but before I do, before I talk about this Confederate unit, the 26th North Carolina, let me categorically tell you that I hate slavery. I'm not pro-slavery. The South was wrong about slavery. The South should have freed the slaves. It was wrong, but the South was right about state sovereignty. And it is my opinion, if the states would rise back up, we wouldn't be in jeopardy like we are right now. Where are these governors when they heard that these 87,000 IRS agents are going to be weaponized and sent after us? Why didn't our governor in Oklahoma, why didn't the governor in Florida, the governor of Texas stand up and say, you're not coming to our states? Where are these men? So I call upon our governor and our government, stand up and do what you're called to do. Protect the citizens of this state. It'd be different if they're just trying to find where we're illegally not paying our taxes. But we all know that's not what those 87,000 agents are about. So I want to tell you the story of the 26th North Carolina. Now, I brought with me some weapons that are from the Battle of Gettysburg. The illustration is going to come from the battle. I don't have anything from the 26th North Carolina, but I do have a musket carried by a soldier from North Carolina who served in the 43rd in Company I. His name was George Dunlap. He fought on the first day's battlefield, and then days 2 and 3 he fought on Culp's Hill. He carved his name on this side of the stock, and right down here it says Company I, 43rd R, NC, North Carolina. I've had this right where he fought. If you go to tours, go on tours with me, you'll hold this right where George Dunlap used this musket. When we're finished, you need to come up here and hold this. This is your history. This is your story. It was there. And then I have, and by the way, understand these have not been fired for 150 years and they're empty. So they are safe. This is a Mississippi rifle carried by a soldier from Tennessee, served in the 1st Tennessee. His name was Edward Myrick. He actually carried this the morning off to the right of where these soldiers that I'm about to talk about before I finish had fought. His name is carved right here, his initials. Someone did the no-no and refinished the gun, which they should have never done. If you have anything old like that, don't refinish it. But I have it because his initials are there and it says 1st Tennessee. If you flip open the patch box, you'll see his initials, EM, carved right here. So when you come up here afterwards, hold this. He fought in the 1st Tennessee on day one. Most infantrymen did not have a revolver, but he did. Probably picked it up on a battlefield. And so he took and he carved his initials, EM. You'll see it's the same person. Carved at the very bottom of this. He fought on day one, July the 1st, 1863. And then on day three, the 1st Tennessee participated in what we all know as Pickett's Charge. After Pickett's Charge was over and the Confederates actually tallied their books, he was found missing in action. So somewhere either on day one or day three, Edward Myrick was killed, most likely buried in an unmarked, unknown grave, and may have been some of those soldiers that they carried off to Hollywood, Richmond, in Richmond, Virginia, Hollywood Cemetery in the 1880s, or maybe he's still on the battlefield somewhere there. There's soldiers all over that battlefield. Now, I want to tell you just very briefly the story of the 26th North Carolina. This is their monument. If you've ever been there with me, you've seen it. We've stood right there. If you look off to the left and behind it, you can see that the ground slopes off pretty sharply. And if you keep following that, you'll come to a body of water that, where I'm from, we call them creeks. They call them runs in Pennsylvania. It's called Willoughby Run. And then on the other side of that was the Confederate forces. They charged up this hill. It was grown just like this. And then they crossed what is now a present-day road that was not there then and engaged a Union regiment, the 24th Michigan, who were a part of the famous Iron Brigade. And they fought some of the most fierce fighting of that battle. Let me read this very short account, and you'll know why as I read it. With 843 soldiers, the 26th North Carolina was the largest regiment in either army at Gettysburg. Commanded by the boy general, 21-year-old Colonel Henry King Burgwyn, the officers of the 26th were anxious to enter the fight before the day was done. Finally, at 2:30 p.m., the 26th and the rest of Pettigrew's brigade was ordered forward. With Colonel Burgwyn taking his place at the center of the regiment, he's 21 years of age and he's a colonel leading these men. A man by the name of J.B. Mansfield, the regimental color bearer, stepped out in front of the line with the regiment's square battle flag. 8 other members of the 26th Color Guard joined Mansfield at the front. "Forward, march," came the order. As they neared a stream known as Willoughby Run, the Yankees fired, but fired high. The 26th paused to return the fire and then made a dash for the tangled banks of the run. Before they even reached the stream, Private John Stamper grabbed the regiment's colors as they entered into the brush near the stream, but fell before he made it across. Private George Washington Kelly next took up the flag, and leaping across the water, Kelly fell to the ground, hit by shrapnel in his leg. Kelly's friend, L.A. Thomas, then picked up the flag and began to move up the hillside. Thomas was hit shortly afterwards and handed the flag to soldier Private John Vinson. Private Vinson, in turn, was promptly wounded and the flag was passed to John Marley. Marley, who was quickly dispatched by hissing bullet. A 10th unnamed man took his turn holding the colors. In just 10 minutes, the 26th North Carolina had lost 10 color bearers. One a minute. The Union and Confederate soldiers stood toe-to-toe in the deep woods, it's called McPherson's Woods, with less than 40 yards, some say 20 paces. Just imagine this. There's 20 paces between them. And poured deadly fire and volleys into each other. Colonel Burgwyn took up the 26th colors and stepped forward. The 26th formed on their colonel. And Private Frank Honeycutt moved forward to take the flag from his colonel. And as Colonel Burgwyn turned to hand the flag to Honeycutt, he was struck by a bullet to the chest and was mortally wounded and died just moments later. As Colonel Burgwyn fell to the forested floor, Honeycutt grabbed the flag, but it immediately hit him in the head by a bullet. As the Carolina men prepared for yet another charge, their flag now lay on the ground. Lieutenant Blair, seeing the prostrate flag and knowing its recent history, yelled out, "No man can take those colors and live!" Lieutenant Colonel J.R. Lane, who was now in command of the regiment, concurred, but picked up the flag nonetheless and yelled, "26th, follow me!" Lane, carrying the regiment's flag, continued to urge his men forward, but he too was soon struck down by a terrible wound to the back of the neck. For the 14th and final time, the 26th colors went down. Here's an artist's rendition of Colonel Bergwin as he's handing the flag off to Private Honeycutt when he's hit in the chest. Here's the flag that the 26th Carolina carried that day in those woods. The fight between the 24th Michigan and the 26th North Carolina proved to be the bloodiest regimental engagement of the Battle of Gettysburg. Both regiments suffered the greatest number of regimental casualties in their respective armies at Gettysburg. Of their 843 soldiers, the 26th North Carolina suffered some 687 casualties, including its colonel and lieutenant colonel. That's an 81.5% casualty rate. And 14 color bearers lifted up the flag and carried it on, only to fall in the process. So here's my question to you. Who will lift up the banner of the Lord? If Paul and I, rather than being prosecuted by the federal government, become persecuted by the federal government, and I think as you've seen this week, though that is a terrible prospect, it's actually a feasible possibility. What will happen? I'll never forget a man in my church in Yukon, a good friend by the name of Tony, came up to me one day and he said, "Dan, I don't know if you know this, but we know the tremendous pressure you are under." At that time, I was serving as the pastor of that church, about 1,000 people. I was serving in the legislature here in Oklahoma, and I was traveling around doing the Black Robe presentation. He said, "Dan, we know that you're marked." And I said, "Well, Tony, I don't know." He said, "No, I think you are." And he said, "I don't know when or if it will ever happen." But he said, "Dan, there's the possibility that some Sunday you could be up there preaching and some federal agent will kick the door open to the church and they'll come up on stage and arrest you." I said, "Well, let's hope it never comes to that." He said, "Well, me too, but..." He said, "Some of us men have gotten together and we've decided that if that were to ever happen, as they lead you off the stage, I'm the first man and I'm going to walk up there and I'm going to pick up the microphone, and though I'm not a preacher like you, I'm going to try to pick up where you left off. And then we've all agreed that if they arrest me, the next man's going to come up and pick up the microphone. And the next man. And the next man. And the next man. We will not surrender. We will not surrender." Now you say, "Well, Dan, you're kind of, in a sense, stretching things, aren't you?" Well, let's go back to Exodus here as we close. In Exodus 17:9, you remember I told you they're at Rephidim and they're going to fight the Amalekites. You remember what Moses told Joshua? He said, "Now look, Joshua, you choose us some men." By the way, that's something the church desperately needs more of. Some men. And I don't mean just males. I mean bold, courageous individuals, men and women. But where have the men gone in this generation? "Choose us some men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." They didn't have a flag. They had the rod of God. You know what Moses is saying here? "I'm going to lift up the colors." What he's doing is he's going to go up on the hill. Because you remember during the war between the states with all the black powder and the smoke, many times the soldiers couldn't see where all of their buddies were. But if they saw their flag, and all their flags were unique to every regiment, if they saw that flag, they could, as the old song says, rally around the flag, boys. Because they could see that flag. Well, as the Israelites fought the Amalekites in the valley, as they would look up there, Moses was holding the staff of God high. And you know what the Bible says? When the staff was held high, the Israelites prevailed. But Moses, being human, his arms would get tired. You know the story. So he would lower his arms to rest. And the moment he did, the Amalekites would start winning. Well, this is devastating. So he'd try to hold it back up. Well, finally, Aaron and Hur saw what was going on. They said, "We got to help him." And you know what they did? They ran up there, and one on either side grabbed an arm. And just like in that clip that you saw a while ago of the 54th Massachusetts, if this man falls, who will lift up the colors and carry on? Just like you saw with the 26th North Carolina, 14 men fell doing that very thing. Moses, Aaron, and Hur held those colors high. And the children of God prevailed. You remember when Isaiah said he heard the Lord say, "Who shall I send? And who will go for us?" Friends, I don't mean to sound cryptic or like a prophet of doom. I don't know the future. But I got to tell you, I'm anxious about the future. I think there is the possibility, if things do not change and we don't pull this republic out of this nosedive, that I could spend my final years in prison. I don't want that. I'm not predicting that. But I'm telling you, I think there's a chance that guys like Paul and me are going to be not prosecuted, though we will be, but persecuted by a leftist government. If that were to happen, who among you will lift the colors and carry on? Is there anyone who will say today, "There's one. I will lift the colors. There's one. There's another. There's one. There's some. There's others. And I will carry on." To God be the glory. We stand. And like Paul says, having done all, stand. So this has been a very different sermon. I know it. So we're going to end it very differently. Just remain standing. Typically, at the end of a service, we give the opportunity for those who don't know Christ to come and pray with someone and give their life to Jesus. Others to join the church. Other Christians that are kind of out of God's will to get things straightened out. You can still do that. We'll have some folks around the stage here. We'd be happy to pray with you. All you got to do is just say, "Hey, I need to pray with someone." But instead of having the typical invitation that we normally have, I'm going to ask you to seriously consider what you're doing right now. See, it's easy enough to stand today. We don't have armed IRS agents beating our doors down yet. You don't have the Department of Justice trumping up charges against you. Will you still stand if those things start to happen? Will we stand and speak out even when those things haven't happened to us yet, but are already, as we can see, happening to others? And whether you're a Trump supporter or not is immaterial to me. What happened to him on Tuesday was wrong. It was wrong. It's the first time in history that that's happened here in America, at least since we whipped the redcoats and sent them back across the Atlantic Ocean. Friends, this is serious. So I want to pray a prayer of commitment and consecration with you. Because like you, I intend to stand. God help me, I intend to stand. And if someday my grandchildren are asking, "Where was their geese?" That's me. "Where was their geese when they were locking people up for standing for what's right?" I hope that their grandmother and their parents can say he was shouting it from the housetop. And he was waving the colors as high as he could. Father, in Jesus' name, what we've heard today is terrifying. Not a one of us wants violence. Not a one of us wants a war of bullets and bombs. But Lord, I fear. And I know we're not supposed to be afraid. I use that word loosely. But I fear that if the church does not awaken, that's exactly what we're going to have. Or even worse, we'll just surrender without a fight. And the gospel will be driven underground and churches will just become symbols that mean nothing. Lord, I pray for people like myself and Paul. We're not better than anybody else. We're not braver. In fact, I think I'm probably not braver than most. But we want to be. We march under your banner. We fight under your banner. And we will die under your banner. Lord, I don't know what the future holds for this state. I don't know what it holds for this union of states. But Lord, if things don't change, it does not look good. Father, help us. Maybe this is what it took. Maybe it will take worse before we'll really wake up. It's easy for us to stand here today. There's no pressure. Will we stand like this when the chips are down? God, I pray we will. So Lord, empower us by your Spirit. We know that the answer is not government. I know the answer is the gospel. I know that this kingdom that we're talking about is eternal. America, you could do your kingdom and America have never existed. You don't need America. Our faith is not in America. But Lord, this has been the freest land maybe in the history of man. And we'd sure like our children and our grandchildren to enjoy the liberties that we have. If they don't, I am firmly convinced it's because the church of my generation refused to lift up the flag, refused to lift up the colors and carry on. God, help that to never be. Draw us to yourself. And if there's any mercy or grace left for this land, we ask you for it. We ask you to send a revival in the pulpits, a revival in the pews. God, make us the shining city on a hill. But if we're so far into the game and we're so close to the last days, that may not happen. Then help us to stand firm, unapologetic, and bold for you. I pray this in the marvelous name of Jesus. And everybody said, amen. Amen.